Tähelepanu, tähelepanu, vaikust. Eetris on küberkäest ja endiselt saade, mis siis seletab saadavalt lahti olulise tahke müstilisest kübermaailmast. Täna lihtsalt külalised või külaline räägib meil jällegi inglise keeles ja teeme siis siit ka vastava ülemineku. So, in today's episode.
In today's episode. In one of our first episodes, we talked about threat intelligence. And we dive deep into how intelligence is gathered and how SOC uses this information on daily basis. The focus was on operational and tactical level, but we also have a wider picture, a strategic threat intelligence. Today we will cover what is that magical animal called strategic threat intelligence and how it can guide us to make better decisions. It is a pleasure to greet our guest from Recorded Future. Again, greetings, Hanner. I'm so sorry. Did I pronounce the name?
That's perfect pronunciation. So Hanner, like Ryanair, Hanner. Come Hanner. Fly with Hanner.
Hanner, yep. That's great. Welcome to the show. And Seem?
Me.
And
Seem, Ronny. As usual. And
yes.
Ronny.
Yes, as usual.
But before we dive deep into today's topic, there are like regular... request that if you hear something interesting from our show, then please share it with your information and always click this like button in SoundCloud and Spotify or Apple Podcast when you're listening to us.
Yes, and then also comment and send emails.
Yes, give us some kind of feedback and
yes,
topics
yes.
to dive deep.
Yes, and I have also a giveaway. Yes, I have a giveaway. So if you give us good feedback, you can give bad feedback as well. That's also good. Then I have a USB killer. You know, this dongle that you put into your USB device, like a computer or a TV, and it will kill it. I will give this to you.
I like that.
Yeah, just give feedback, write emails, likes, comments, shares, and we will give one out. Sigrid told me not to give, but I'm giving.
Okay, but let's go to the topic. First of all, Hanner, please introduce yourself a little bit and what is your role in the world of threat intelligence?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I'm Hanner. I'm a senior intelligence consultant at Recorded Future, which, if you haven't heard of, is the world's most comprehensive threat intelligence cloud platform. So my role at the moment is to basically put intelligence at the center of teams' functions. So it could be a threat intelligence team, a SOC team, but it also could be broader, so vulnerability management teams, even compliance as well. So it's to try and put intelligence in the center of these different teams' operations.
Could you please explain us a little bit more thoroughly that in the introduction we mentioned that we have somewhat already covered the operational and tactical threat intelligence, and there is also the strategic threat intelligence, which is like the main topic for this show. But could you go over of three of those and explain a little bit more, like what are those and what they consist of?
Yeah, sure. So you have, as you said, tactical, operational and strategic intelligence. So if we start with tactical, so when we think about these different kind of levels of intelligence, we need to think about timing and action. So with tactical intelligence, it's kind of acting in real time, quick action. So it could be if you're working within a SOC, an event happens, you need to block something. It could be that. It could be very kind of, typically it's very adversary focused in terms of TTPs, IOCs, and it's a quick action that you take in real time.
So this means that that in your operations, in your I don't know, firewall or in your antivirus product or in your whatever enforcer point, mm-hmm. Is able to access that threat intelligence information and make a quick decision onto blocking or doing something.
Yeah, exactly. There needs to be still intelligence, right? So there needs to be some level of analysis there you need to make, that needs to be decision made of the threat. But yeah, it needs to be quick, pretty much. So it'd be maybe a daily or, you know, hourly activity that's taken.
Mm-hmm. So this information needs to be correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and then to go into operational. So there are overlaps between operational and tactical, but operational is more kind of longer term in terms of thinking of how day-to-day operations are run. So it could be thinking about how resources are done, planning for doing things like threat profiling, which, yeah, you might look at actors, you might look at their TTPs and their IOCs, but you might be looking at more of the threat landscape as well. So looking at wider trends. It's not just that immediate action.
So what is an actor?
So when we speak about actors, we speak about threat actors, so an adversary. So it could be a user on Telegram who's, you know, conducting DDoS activity, targeting a company. It could be a nation state group, a cyber criminal group, hacktivist group. It could even be an insider. So any sort of threat who is either intentionally or with insiders as well, unintentionally causing kind of malicious activity, that's what we can call an actor.
You have also mentioned a couple of other acronyms like TTPs and IOCs. Could you also like open those ones?
Yeah, sure. So we like in cyber, we like our acronyms, which is actually problematic. But yeah, so IOC, indicator of compromise. So that would be typically an IP address, a hash, a URL or a domain which is malicious or it's linked to a threat actor or one of these actors' campaigns. So when we talk about campaigns, say, for example, if we see an actor targeting the healthcare industry over a period of time, we'd call that a campaign run by that actor. And when we talk about TTPs, and I always get this wrong sometimes because you have tactics, techniques and procedures, and sometimes I say tools, so I get it wrong all the time also. But this is talking about the methods that these actors are using. So IOCs, very easy block, but actually what's more interesting is looking at the methods, because in the long term, say for example, you know an actor likes to use valid credentials that they've stolen as part of initial access to gain access to a system. What you should focus on is rather than just blocking IOCs that are associated with that actor, because they might have a short life cycle, right? An actor could change its infrastructure all the time. You should focus on the actual method and say, okay, they like to use valid credentials. Maybe we should look at educating our employees to make sure that they've got good password knowledge and, you know, they know how to set up good passwords. Maybe we should have like internal systems where we reset our passwords on a monthly basis and we have a good and basic password policy. So that's a longer term.
And I have a question from audience. I have a listener question.
Yeah.
And that question goes, please explain the life cycle of IOC.
Yeah. So I was thinking about, the life cycle of an IOC. And I think from a SOC perspective, I guess, and I've never actually worked in a SOC, but I guess it's kind of the moment where you detect the IOC to kind of investigating it and quickly making that triage decision of what you do there. And Sim, correct me if I'm wrong on that.
You're absolutely correct.
Okay, great. So that, I guess that's what we talk about in, I guess, official terms of the IOC. But this is kind of what I was alluding to as well. So you have that life cycle, but what's really important is to step, you know, outside one higher level and think about beyond IOCs are security controls, right? So what are the methods that these actors are using, the TTPs, and what security controls do we have in place? Because the IOCs do have a life cycle in terms of, again, they might change. And what we should focus on is actually the methods there, so we have longer term protections in place to defend ourselves.
So just for the listeners to understand, IOC is an indicator of compromise. What does it kind of consist of? What are the components of IOC?
Yeah, so it's basically the infrastructure that an attacker uses as part of its attack. So it could be the website that they register where they host a phishing site, right? Where a banking user might go onto this website and put in their credentials. It could be a website that they use to make a bad email address that's impersonating a bank. It could be an IP address that they use as part of their communications when they basically target a company and they have malware on that company's infrastructure. They might use an IP address to communicate with the company's infrastructure so that they can take information. So it's basically like the makeup of that actor, what that actor is using as its foundation so it can conduct its malicious activities.
So yeah, you will spin this IOC, and this IOC consists of the attacker kind of technical parameters, like IP addresses, URLs, hashes, whatever kind of indicators that can be kind of correlated or matched to.
Yeah.
So, and you will spin this IOC out to the world. Whoever can get it can use it. Then it's alive. But when does it die?
So, I mean, it depends. Some IOCs never die, so they're recycled back to. So, I mean, with a nation state group, say that they might use IOCs or infrastructure, and then they'll use it for a specific campaign, and then they're done with it, and it's dormant. And that's why at Recorded Future, we have what we call risk scores, and we have risk rules. So we're using dynamic risk rules to basically see the malicious life cycle of an IOC to see, okay, this IP address was being used by an APT a year ago, but now it's completely benign. So the risk rule has gone down. Sorry, the risk score has gone down, so we don't care about it as much. Whereas with other IOCs, cyber criminals in particular, they're known to share malicious infrastructure. So you'll see with their activity, an IP address will be used. It might have a kind of a bit of a break, and then it'll be used again, and so on. And that's because also between these groups, tool sets are being shared as well, infrastructure is being shared. So it's harder to kind of know when that IOC is going to die, because it might never die. So
okay. Yeah. So some live longer than others.
Yeah. And then I guess when it comes to hashes and files, if you have a malicious hash, that's one thing you can never kind of change a hash. So you know that that will always be somewhere basically malicious. If you identify a hash that was once malicious on your infrastructure, that most likely will still be, or almost certainly will still be malicious. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the listener got pretty good and thorough answer.
Greetings, Sven.
I think we have now covered the tactical and operational threat intelligence part quite well. And now let's go to the strategic one. Explain, what is the strategic threat intelligence?
Sure. So we said, you know, tactical is immediate, operational is kind of more day to day. And then I'd say strategic is the longer term planning. So it's more for an executive audience, a higher level, and it's for the decision maker. So it could be, you know, something to inform a new decision that needs to be made for the business. So a good strategical question could be, you know, is this location safe for my employees to go to? That could be kind of a more strategical intelligence requirement. And as part of that, you know, you'd provide the audience with an assessment of whether it's safe for employees to go to that location. So again, it's not the quick action. It's not day-to-day kind of threatscaping. It's that bigger kind of higher level overview that's needed for a decision maker.
What does it consist of? Okay, I understand that there is embassies. So your embassy, you would say that don't go to Russia, for example. So that's kind of, that's also long term. But how does it work in cyber? What do you mean? Don't go to that website, or what does it?
Yeah, so I guess with locations, I mean, in that use case, it could be, you have the physical, but also you have, you know, the risk of that employee's devices. On that employee's device, they'll have organizational confidential data. Is it safe from an information security perspective as well for my employees to go there? Because in some locations, you know, it might not be safe in terms of how the internet access is controlled, and in terms of kind of, what type of data you're looking after as well. It might not be safe. And we know that certain groups are interested in individuals, especially when we look at political individuals, but also individuals who work within security. They could be high priority targets for certain states like Russia, like China, like Iran. So from the information security perspective as well, that's something to consider.
Mm-hmm. I get the feeling that this is kind of the level where the, how can I say, the line between the, like, how can I say, the real world and the cyberspace kind of gets somewhat blurry. So it seems that the strategic view is something like more general that we see around us, and not like maybe something particularly technical.
Definitely, it's the bigger questions and the ones that, yeah, again, needs more kind of executive decision making around it.
But how does it transform into interactions, into operational and into tactics?
That's a great question. I think it's the other way around. So I think the tactical kind of informs the operational, and then what people on the ground are seeing from an operational kind of accumulates into the strategic. I see it going from the root to the top.
It's kind of like a long trend analysis and into foreseeing what might happen tomorrow based on a trend.
Yeah, exactly. What we're seeing today, and those on the ground can kind of, from what they've seen on a daily basis, they can start to, exactly what you've said, draw trends to then inform decision makers on what is likely to come and what to expect. And then I guess it's a whole cycle as well. So then decision makers can say, okay, based on what we've seen, we want to focus, those on the ground on this.
But what do decision makers ask?
That's a great question as well. So, I mean, it depends on... I mean, I've worked with lots of different companies, and it depends what level of security maturity a company has. So you have some companies where those at the top will have what we call priority intelligence requirements. So those are a list of questions where they need to know, in order to run our security function or a threat intelligence function, we need to know the answers to these questions. So it could be, are Russian groups targeting our industry and so on. At the decision making level, some companies have that, some don't as well. So they kind of might just be more reactive. So when something comes, then they might, say, for example, massive vulnerabilities disclose that affects something that you use, an item of technology that you use, and mass scanning's happening. And then maybe the executive will need to know something about that to make a decision in terms of how they respond. Depending on the size of the company as well. So, some are reactive and some are more proactive in that they actually do have a set list of priority requirements that they need to know and they need answered.
Okay.
But how is this strategic threat intelligence gathered? You explained previously that in some sense it comes from like the bottom up, that the technical and operational information is observed, and maybe then the strategical information is kind of deducted from it. Is there like any other ways how to gather this information based on which those high level decisions can be made?
Yeah, so if you haven't heard of the intelligence cycle, this is something that at Recorded Future we really model what we do on, and most intelligence entities across the world will do this, from military to cyber and so on. So what this essentially is when to make something intelligence, it needs to answer a question, right? It needs to have a purpose. So things like a list of IOCs, that's great, but that's just data, that's not human readable. If you have a sentence of this list of IOCs is linked to this actor, that's great, but that's just information. So in order for it to be intelligence, it needs to answer a question, basically. So at the beginning, the first kind of stage of the intelligence cycle was planning and direction. And for me, for strategic intelligence, you need to have a question. It could be three questions, but you need to have something that you want answered. Otherwise, what's the point? It's just people coming together and doing research, right? So you need to have planning, and you need to have direction. And a part of that, you can then go into your collection stage, which is where you plan which sources you're going to kind of query, which sources are relevant, so you can start to gather the data together that you need in order to start to do processing and analysis. And again, this is where you take if you're an analyst, you take everything from your collection, you start to go through it, what's relevant, what's not, and you start to process it, and then you make analysis from that. So you might say this is relevant, and you might use it within an assessment to answer the question that you have at hand. And then you go into dissemination. So that's how you deliver the intelligence. So it depends on what the audience needs. It could be a briefing where you stand up and speak. It could be a quick one pager. It depends what's needed. but then that needs to be disseminated and it needs to be done in a timely way as well. So the worst thing is when you get something, you get intelligence and it's late. That's not intelligence. That's not timely. What's the point? It needs to be when the decision maker needs it, because if you tell them the day after it happens, that's just redundant to them as well. So it still needs to, the whole point here is it needs to answer a question and it needs to be, it needs to go through this intelligence cycle process.
How difficult it is to kind of like predict the future, because currently you like described that the, well, the intelligence has the real value when it's like really, really timely and maybe like a little bit earlier when like actual things happening. So how easy or difficult it is?
Yeah, it depends on, I mean, obviously there's different factors here at play. There's kind of technological advances and obviously geopolitical factors at hand as well, which we can't always predict. But just on a day-to-day from an operational perspective, in order to inform strategic level decision-making, one good exercise to do is threat profiling. So that's where you kind of look at the intent, so the willingness of an actor to target you. So that could be, for example, if you're in the healthcare industry and you've seen an actor target the healthcare industry, that might show that they have intent to target you too, because you know that they're interested in your industry. And then looking at opportunity as well, which is how exposed are you? So do you have lots of unpatched vulnerabilities? Do you have lots of exposed credentials? Do you have misconfigurations and so on? And as part of that, you look at, okay, is an actor wanting to target me? So intent, can they? Exposure. And then you also look at their capability as well. So at the moment, what does it look like out there? Like from what we're seeing, how capable are actors? Are they strongly skilled and so on? And then by looking at that, you can do profiling where you say, okay, at the top here, we have X, Y, and Z. They're most likely to target us and be successful. And we can predict that they, you know, with a realistic possibility that they might target us within the next 3 to 6 months. And then you can plan for that and start to kind of, by looking at how they act, their methods, start to put in the security controls in place to make sure that you're better defended from them.
So do you have a success story to share with us?
Let me just think about this. Not that I can specifically give, if I'm completely honest, but I know that this is something that customers are doing. And I'll be honest, when things go right, it's not always the time that customers share the details with you. Mm-hmm. But I know it's something that actually, I'd say 2 years ago, not many customers were doing this. But this is something that customers are really focusing on at the moment. So yeah, sorry for that.
That's no. Don't be.
Just to be, yeah, candid.
I just had to ask this question because in cybersecurity,
yeah,
you know, they don't tend to share. So that's completely okay.
No, if I ever got that story, it'd be great as well. But it's something that is being a lot more focused on, and it comes back also to the increasing, not redundancy of IOCs, but they're becoming less important. And they're still important, but they're becoming less important. It's again looking at the longer term of what's likely to happen based on our threatscape, and then based on this profiling exercise, that's becoming more relevant.
You mentioned geopolitics also briefly previously. How much the like geopolitical events and we know that wars definitely have some kind of effect in the cyberspace also, but like other like maybe simpler things like elections or events like that, how those affect the cyberspace and does the like intelligence show that there are some connections?
Yeah, definitely. So localized events definitely are becoming more interest to especially nation state groups. So previously we saw states like Russia before 2014, when the gunning of the Air Malaysia flight happened, Russia used to typically focus inwards and, you know, focus on information operations against its own populations. And what we're seeing now increasingly is, in the case of Russia, is it look more outwards. So it's focusing on influencing societies globally. So you can see we just did a report on Copycat, which is an actor basically, well, we've linked it to Russia, but basically targeting the US election to influence opinion through creating kind of fake sites, using Gen AI as well to create content to have influence. And we're seeing it within Africa as well, which is where the Russia linked groups are more likely to have influence as well, because it's more, there's more vulnerable populations there. But we're seeing this as an increasing kind of trend, and the same with China as well. So China doesn't do it so well, but China's increasingly looking outwards, especially since COVID, where it really tried to regain, I guess, public opinion over how it was perceived. China has started to do this and use information operations to try and influence local populations on their opinion on China.
What do you think, like, how big of a role this evolving of the generative AI has, how can I say, what's the word, influenced this, like, disinformation campaigns? Like, can we kind of see some direct correlation that when the generative AI started evolving rapidly, then also the disinformation campaigns like went?
Yeah, 100%. So this is something that we, or our research team Insect, have been looking at, but like looking at content on some of these kind of Russia linked sites where 80% has been made by kind of, it's been AI generated and so on. It's just a time saver, right? And also it makes campaigns more convincing. So you don't need to speak English because you can have this perfectly eloquent sentences. That's what Gen AI is great at. It's not, you know, there to be completely factual. It's good at making sentences. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's convincing. So for that kind of content, it's perfect. And then you have imagery as well and videos. You have deep fakes, which are fake video content. You have imagery as well, which is being increasingly used, and it's very, very convincing. So I think I don't know in terms of metrics, but 100% there is a correlation with more convincing and a higher quantity of Gen AI being used within these campaigns, and the increase in these campaigns as well. And it's also time with many elections which are occurring this year in the UK, in the US and so on. Since ChatGPT has been released, this is the first time that we're having elections in these destinations, so it is really important.
That's very interesting. Since we like touched the disinformation and the generative AI, yeah, could you also like do you have any kind of tips how to like
how to use ChatGPT for phishing?
No, like how to recognize the disinformation.
Yeah, because you mentioned it's like 80%. So do you have some kind of detection mechanism, or how would you?
Yeah, I believe online there are tools that you can use. I don't actually have one at hand, but I know that Insect used some in their recent reporting on a campaign that we dubbed Doppelganger, which is another Russian link campaign. But I think there are tools that you can use as well. A lot of it is around employee education, I think, as well. So I don't know if you heard, but this year there was an instance of fraud where a voice was cloned as well, using basically deepfake technology. And this convinced an employee to give $25 million, I think it was, in a transfer. And this was done in a really convincing way, right? They used this voice kind of AI technology to join a business conferencing call, mm-hmm, with the target, and then, you know, convince them to transfer the money. So I think having kind of education around this, because still this is still the same methods that are being used. So first there was a phishing email that was sent to him, or kind of a social engineering type email sent to the employee who was the victim to ask for a call. And then he got on the call and then he sent the money. And you can still have, you know, steps in place there to defend you. So, you know, it might get harder to identify when Gen AI text is there, but you should still have employee education in place to say, okay, before you ever send money to someone over the phone to a new bank account, you need to do X, Y, and Z. Because, you know, that should just be a natural.
Do you have any other, like, predictions for the near future, maybe like quarter 3 and 4 that are ahead of us, that what kind of threats we might see in the cyberspace other than again disinformation campaigns? And
yeah, so we're increasingly seeing like a blur between hacktivist nation state actors and these disinformation operations as well. So with recent elections going on, it might be that, you know, we see, I mean, a good example is when the Russia-Ukraine conflict first broke out, we saw APT-41, who's also known as Sandstorm. They did some disruptive operations using wiper malware. And then shortly after, I think it was within a 48-hour period, Mandiant reported that some so-called hacktivist groups like ZACNet leaked information relating to these companies that were first compromised by the nation-state actor APT-41. So I think what we might see as we get closer to these bigger political events, and we have the Olympics coming as well, is some disruptive attacks where nation-state actors might be involved and hacktivist actors, and there might be a blurring there. Disruptive attacks as well. So again, with these events that are happening, these global events and localized events, we might see more disruption. So recently it was reported that Volt Typhoon, who are a China-linked group, have been seen on US critical infrastructure and having a foothold there. And it's predicted by the US that there could be some disruptive types of activities as well. And this is quite new for China-linked groups. Like China is not typically like Russia in doing or authoring disruptive campaigns. So that's something to be aware of as well, especially as the situation with Taiwan escalates. So we could see more disruptive campaigns also because of the Palestine and Israel conflict as well, with other nation state actors and hacktivist groups. There could be more disruption in light of that as well, and how that escalates more.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. Anything about our region?
Yes, the backwaters of...
I think with Estonia, you know, you don't hear loads of reporting. Obviously, it's in a high interest of area for Russia. And I think, you know, what we're seeing here is because you're so close to the Nordics, part of NATO, and with the expansion of NATO recently as well, with Sweden and Finland joining, Russia is more paranoid now than ever. So I think a lot of the threats that the Nordics see kind of extend to here as well. So in terms of potential espionage campaigns, disruption, not just from a cyber perspective, but also more of a technical perspective. So NATO did a lot of exercises, military exercises recently. I think they've just come to an end. And what we saw during those exercises was really increased levels of GPS jamming, which is basically when kind of technical sources are used to try and disrupt GPS signals, right? To disrupt plane journeys and aviation. And at this point, during the last few months, this has not just affected kind of military or NATO flights. This was affecting air ambulances and also civil aviation as well. So civil airlines. So those types of threats as well, not just kind of typical cyber, as in, you know, getting your infrastructure hijacked. I think that's something to be aware of. Also, we have in Estonia, you have a gas pipe going to Finland as well. So I know that last year you had damage done to that Baltic connector. And at the moment, I think that's still under investigation, but it looked like it was a Chinese ship that did that as well. So that's quite interesting in seeing if any actors will do any physical damage to the infrastructure around Estonia as well, just considering how close you are to the Nordics. So I think it's one to watch, but it'd be interesting as well to see how things unfold in the next few months.
That's pretty great. I think it has been quite interesting conversation, and time flies pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's time to slowly wrap things up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think listeners got like pretty good idea out of like what is kind of the strategic level information and how it can be used.
Thank you, Hanner, for did I get it right?
Yeah, perfect. Hanner, Ryanair.
Thank you, Hanner, for coming to our show.
No worries.
I think that we need strategical information.
Yeah, because again, one thing is that to react something and like maybe find block something but it would be a lot greater if we can somewhat like
direct our investments or direct our efforts into correct slots and be aware of what happens.
Yeah, and keep an eye on those kind of things. So maybe predict something and be well prepared.
Yeah.
But yes, if you like the show, then like it, share it, comment it, and there is a USB killer waiting for you in on my desk. Just write me an email.
Yes.
Yes.
And I guess it's time to wrap up.
Yes.
Thank you, Henner, for sharing all your knowledge with us. And
until next time, because Henner is with us.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Cheers.
Thank you.
Okay. See you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.